Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Janine Jackson, here with Steve Rendell. This week on Counterspin, the latest UN report on Iran's nuclear program has been published, but what it says depends on which U.S. news outlet you depend on. Does it describe an ominous march toward Iran's nuclear weaponization, as is suggested by many stories, or something less serious? We'll be joined by Pepe Escobar, roving eye columnist for Asia Times Online and correspondent for the Real News Network, to talk about what the UN report actually says. Also on the show, presumptive Republican presidential nominee John McCain has publicly rejected the endorsements of televangelists John Hagee and Rod Parsley. That is, after some of the Reverend's more irreverent remarks were widely broadcast. Our guest says this in no way signals the end of the influence of the movement these pastors are part of. We'll hear from Sarah Posner, author of God's Prophets, Faith, Fraud, and the Republican Crusade for Values Voters. All of that's coming up, but first, as usual, we'll take a brief look back at the week's press.
Newsweek's June 2nd cover package, Obama, Race, and Us, offers a series of pieces that explore a simple question. Will Americans vote for a black presidential candidate? The magazine developed a poll it called the Racial Resentment Index to help provide an answer, and the issue's main article seems to offer a clear verdict. Quote, even as he closes in on the Democratic nomination for the presidency, Senator Barack Obama is facing lingering problems winning the support of white voters, including some in his own party, close quote. The magazine goes on to say, Obama's race may well explain his difficulty in winning over white voters. Buried in the piece, though, is evidence to the contrary. Looking at polls of white voters at similar points in the respective campaigns, Obama scores better than recent Democratic candidates John Kerry and Al Gore. So Obama's race could be less important than Newsweek seems to think. That is, according to Newsweek's own reporting. The magazine's editor, John Meacham, declared on NBC's Meet the Press that the whole race discussion, quote, makes white people very queasy, close quote. The same could be said of some of Newsweek's readers who made it through Evan Thomas's piece that offered Obama some advice. Whites resent being accused of racism for remarks they regard as innocent or innocuous, Thomas wrote, going on to explain that, quote, one of the strengths of your campaign has been to get past the old-style politics practiced by the Reverends Al Sharpton and Jesse Jackson and other race men who use skin color as a political tool, close quote. One of the most disturbing aspects of campaign punditry has been watching white pundits talk about trading up for Obama. In their minds, his victories would reassign leaders like Sharpton and Jackson to the sidelines. That such commentary would appear in a magazine trying to elevate the discussion of race shows just how far we have to go.
More in that vein, unfortunately. Counterspin noted last week that the Washington Post Writers Group had chosen to syndicate a frankly racist column by Kathleen Parker. We weren't the only ones dismayed by the group's decision to offer a prominent platform for Parker's screed about the bloodlines of candidates John McCain and Barack Obama. The outcry led the public editor at the Chicago Tribune, which ran the column, to respond. But Timothy McNulty's May 23rd response did nothing to assuage readers' unhappiness. Under the headline, Racism Needs to Stay in Light, McNulty argued that providing a megaphone for Parker's hateful sentiments was really a healthy exercise in anti-racism. Sure, her ideas were repugnant, but, quote, I would rather see it on the op-ed page so that people can hold it to the light and repudiate the notion rather than deal with it as a whispering campaign, close quote. Unfortunately, McNulty has no evidence for the strange notion that presenting unopposed racist views in the paper really has the effect of squelching such views in the larger society. Intuition might suggest that actually such campaigns would be emboldened by finding an echo for their sentiments in what are deemed legitimate news outlets. Also unconvincing is his argument that the opposite of broadcasting racism far and wide would be to, quote, hide or pretend those attitudes don't exist, close quote. In reality, Americans have plenty of evidence that racism exists, thanks, without seeing it elaborated at length in the press. Perhaps the most disturbing thought would be that McNulty really believes his own thesis that promoting bad ideas repudiates them. One has to wonder what admittedly repugnant opinions Tribune readers can look forward to reading next.
The New York Times May 23rd review of the HBO movie Recount contained a glaring error about the disputed Florida vote in the 2000 presidential election. As pointed out by media critic Eric Alterman, the New York Times reporter Alessandra Stanley wrote, quote, in 2001, painstaking postmortems of the Florida count, one by the New York Times and another by a consortium of newspapers, concluded that Mr. Bush would have come out slightly ahead even if all the votes counted throughout the state had been retallied, close quote. To take the simpler error first, the Times did not do a separate recount of the ballots. The Times was part of the consortium of newspapers that did a group recount. That Stanley got this wrong strongly suggests that she didn't bother to go back and review the coverage, which explains that part at least quite carefully. Even if she had reviewed the coverage, she might well have gotten the more important part wrong because the initial coverage itself went out of its way to obscure the bottom line, which was, as the New York Times put it well into its November 12, 2001 story, quote, if all the ballots had been reviewed under any of the seven single standards, Mr. Gore would have won, close quote. That is, in fact, the opposite of what Stanley said the recount had found. Stanley has a reputation for being one of the New York Times' most corrected reporters. We'll see if the Times corrects this whopper, which serves as an eerie reminder of journalism's role as the first draft of history.
In March, dozens of veterans of the Iraq and Afghanistan wars gathered in Maryland to offer their firsthand accounts of what they had seen, and in some cases done, in both war zones. Their dramatic testimony was not, for some reason, good enough for the corporate media, which mostly ignored the Winter Soldier hearings. The New York Times public editor Clark Hoyt explained afterwards that they just hadn't received the press releases, which wasn't true, and that it probably wouldn't have mattered anyway, since news outlets, quote, prefer their own on-scene accounts of the war, close quote. But the Winter Soldier story didn't end in March, so the corporate media had a second chance. The group that organized the event, Iraq Veterans Against the War, were invited to Capitol Hill on May 15th to appear before an unofficial hearing of the Congressional Progressive Caucus. And once again, the vets offered remarkable accounts of the war. One might have thought it would be hard for the Beltway media to ignore it a second time, especially considering that the House was debating a war funding bill at the same time. But ignore it they did, offering even less coverage of these hearings than of the March events. One notable exception was the PBS NewsHour, which aired a report on May 21st about Winter Soldier. But they were a lonely exception to the media rule, which seems to be that there is now a little space to talk about certain veterans' issues, like post-traumatic stress and suicide rates, so long as you don't hear from the vets themselves, or at least not this particular group.
Finally, until recently, Barry Nolan was the host of Nightbeat and Backstage, two shows appearing on the Comcast cable channel CN8. That was before he decided to publicly protest a decision by a local Emmy committee in Boston to honor Fox News host Bill O'Reilly. Before the May 10th award ceremony, the veteran television journalist sent emails to colleagues encouraging them to contact Emmy officials with the message that O'Reilly was an appalling choice for an honor. As Nolan explained in a May 27th commentary on thinkprogress.org, he opposed the O'Reilly honor, quote, not because of his political views, but because he simply gets the facts wrong, abuses his guest and the powerless in general, is delusional, and, well, you might want to Google narcissistic personality disorder, close quote. At the award ceremony, Nolan put flyers on tables containing O'Reilly quotes and passages from the sexual harassment lawsuit O'Reilly settled with his former producer. On May 20th, Nolan received word that CN8 was letting him go. Writing about his firing on Think Progress, Nolan said, quote, normally, in the great scheme of things, this should be a total non-story. Overpaid white guy gets fired from cushy job for shooting mouth off. Yawn, close quote. But he concluded there were also bigger issues at stake, quote, it all got me to thinking about the myth of free speech. In today's America, speech is only free when you are talking down to someone less powerful than you. Speak up and look out, close quote.
Thanks, Steve. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. FAIR also publishes a bi-monthly magazine called Extra. I'll be giving subscription information later on in the program.
The latest International Atomic Energy Agency, or IAEA, report on Iran's nuclear program is not uncritical of Iranian compliance with the UN Nuclear Oversight Agency. But what the report actually says is hard to tell if one is depending on U.S. news outlets. Is the Iranian program being militarized or perhaps even nuclear weaponized, as suggested by the New York Times? Or, as the Los Angeles Times reported, is the gist of the UN report just that Iran has not been as forthcoming on some important questions as the IAEA would have liked? Joining us to sort out the coverage of the latest UN report on Iran versus what the report actually says is Pepe Escobar, the roving eye columnist for the Asia Times Online and a correspondent for the Real News Network. Escobar is also the author of Globalistan, How the Globalized World is Dissolving into Liquid War, and Red Zone Blues, a snapshot of Baghdad during the surge. Welcome to Counterspin, Pepe Escobar.
Thanks for having me.
Well, let's talk about the press coverage first. A May 27th New York Times report by Elaine Cialino suggested ominously that Iran's nuclear program may be intended more for military use than for energy generation. But it quotes, her story quotes little from the UN report, favoring instead the opinions of mostly unnamed experts. The same day, the Los Angeles Times report bearing the headline, UN finds no proof Iran continued nuclear arms program, also notes that Iranian officials have not been forthcoming with the agency on some key issues. What was the dominant storyline you found in the U.S. press when you studied the story?
Well, the first thing that I saw was a small AP dispatch quoting the usual unnamed U.S. official blasting Iran. I think it was on the second paragraph. Then AP had a more extensive report actually quoting from the actual IAEA document. The thing is, as soon as we learned that the document was out, was leaked, we called Vienna. We talked to one of the press officers in Vienna, and this person, I cannot tell her name for obvious reasons, she told us where to look to find the leak, the actual leaked report. So while we started to look at the coverage, we already had the report in our hands, and the first dispatches, they were not quoting from the IAEA report. As far as the New York Times story is concerned, Elaine is an excellent reporter, Elaine Cialino. She's an excellent reporter. She's been to Iran. She wrote a book about Iran. So I suspect the New York Times editors had a hand in her own report because it was totally spun to the point of Iran was practically guilty of something. And this is not, when you read the actual report, that's not what's written. They have some misgivings about three particular issues, past issues. But I would say the money quote in the IA report is, I will quote, it should be emphasized, however, that the agency has not detected the actual use of nuclear material in connection with the alleged studies. And I only saw that quote in the first day of the coverage, at least, in an Iranian press TV report. And in most of the American reports, they were not quoting. I think the Los Angeles Times, at least, they inferred that, you know, the IAEA was not actually blaming Iran about anything. They were just complaining that they were not as forthcoming as they should have been.
Well, since the IAEA report was just 9 pages long, reporters can't say they didn't have time to read it, but
of
still.
Of course not. You could actually read it in 10 minutes.
So is what happened here with the reporting, were reporters simply favoring the official spin of the report over the actual report itself?
Absolutely. And this is, we can say this is part of a concerted campaign of demonization of Iran, especially the U.S. corporate press. In Europe, it's a little more balanced. Even in the, like say, El País in Spain, which is a center-right, relatively progressive newspaper, or Le Monde, which is a supposedly center-left newspaper. They, you know, at least Iran has a little bit of a benefit of a doubt. But if you read the U.S. corporate papers and if you tune to CNN and Fox News, it's amazing. It reminds me of what was happening in 2002 during the build-up towards war in Iraq. It's spin. It's not information. And there's no nuance. This report, it is relatively blunt. I agree. That's how the New York Times define it. But there's a lot of nuance as well. They say Iran hasn't come clean in three particular issues. One of them is explosives testing. This is very sensitive. And they apparently they had a missile reentry vehicle project. And the IAEA is basically complaining that they need some background information about these tests, and that Iran actually had answered these questions, but they got the letter late. The responses to the agency letter of 9 May 2008. And then the IAEA report says that they were not received until 23 May 2008. So there was a correspondence mistake, you know. And Iran, on top of it, they say that all these data is fabricated. But they say that it's fabricated, but they are trying to, explain themselves at the same time. So you have to report the nuance in the whole thing.
Well, you mentioned the run-up to the war in Iraq in 2002 and 2003, where reporters more or less taking their cues from the government tended to seize on any sign of noncompliance by Iraq in that case and amplify it. Back then, UNSCOM were saying that Iraq was generally in compliance with inspections, but it came out in the U.S. press that Iraq was really, you didn't get the impression they were.
You're totally right. You remember Hans Blix's press conferences in early 2003? He was saying, look, we haven't found anything. We've been all over the place in Iraq. As far as we know, there is no military nuclear program in Iraq, and nobody believes them. I mean, nobody in terms of U.S. mainstream media.
Well, you mentioned that Iranian press TV got the story more or less right. Isn't it a sad turn of events when we have to depend on Iranian state television to get accurate reporting over our own supposed independent media?
Oh, that tells us a lot about so-called freedom of expression and liberal media, especially in the U.S. It's very, very sad. But it's considering what happened in the, you remember the Judith Miller stories on the cover of the New York Times, for that matter, in 2002, where she was fed disinformation by Ahmed Shalabi on a weekly basis. And this was printed as the truth and as exclusive material. The exact same procedure of manufacturing consent for an attack on Iran is at play here.
We've been speaking with Pepe Escobar. He's the Roving Eye columnist for Asia Times Online and a correspondent for the Real News Network, where his video commentary on coverage of the UN report can be viewed at therealnews.com. Pepe Escobar, thanks again for joining us today on Counterspin.
Thanks. It was a pleasure. Thanks very much.
On May 22nd, CBS Evening News did a story on presumptive Republican presidential nominee John McCain's rejection of the endorsement of televangelist Reverend John Hagee. This was after the wide release of video of Hagee sermonizing that Hitler and the Holocaust were part of God's plan. CBS reporter Chip Reed stated that Hagee has been a thorn in John McCain's side for months now. Today, McCain finally said enough. A little check of CBS Evening News, however, showed exactly one 300-word story on McCain and Hagee back in February when the candidate accepted the endorsement. If it were up to broadcast news then, McCain might not have much of a pastor problem at all. But as big media raced to catch up on folks like Hagee and Ohio televangelist Rod Parsley, whose endorsement McCain also rejected after having called him a spiritual guide, there are people who have been following such folks and the prosperity gospel movement they represent for years now. We're joined now by phone from California by Sarah Posner. She's been covering the religious right for years for the American Prospect and other outlets, and she's author of the book God's Prophets, Faith, Fraud, and the Republican Crusade for Values Voters. Sarah Posner, welcome to Counterspin.
Thanks for having me.
Well, many listeners may have surfed past the Trinity Broadcasting Network and seen folks like Hagee and Parsley and Kenneth Copeland, but then you also see infomercials for blenders and non-surgical facelifts. So I wonder, can you give us just a brief grounding on the scale of the movement that these people represent and their worldview? What are they about?
Well, they definitely represent millions of Americans, a little subculture or a fairly big subculture of American evangelicalism, of charismatic evangelicalism. And basically, their worldview is that God wants believers to be rich and that you get rich by tithing to your pastor. They call it sowing a seed so that you reap a supernatural harvest in return. They also believe that the pastor is an authoritarian figure. So he's God's anointed one. You don't question him. And so when he tells you to tithe before you pay the rent, lest you live under a financial curse, you do that. And so it's a much more powerful movement than most people would think by watching their antics on television, which to outsiders seem very silly almost. But once you go inside the movement and you see how the followers are drawn in by this idea that the pastor represents this voice of authority, that they have the ability to tap into what they call revelation knowledge, meaning that they don't have to listen to reason, they just listen to the pastor and what God tells them.
Well, and there's also a tremendous amount of secrecy surrounding them as well. So if you wanted to find out more about how things are run, you'd have a hard time.
Right, because the IRS, even though they have a tax exemption, the IRS doesn't require churches to file tax returns. So you can't look up how much money was coming in, how much the pastor is being paid. And several of the televangelists, not Hagee or Parsley, are under investigation by the Senate Finance Committee right now. And one of them, probably the most prominent prosperity preacher, Kenneth Copeland, he has resisted turning over financial documents because he says it's none of the government's business how much money he's making.
The Washington Post had a headline on May 29th, "In rebuking minister, McCain may have alienated evangelicals." And that's been sort of the angle of political coverage here. You've written that Republican presidential candidates seeking the support of these preachers, these word of faith preachers for the past three decades, that's really about more than the quest to consolidate the evangelical vote. What did you mean by that?
Well, the word of faith doctrine fits so nicely with Republican and conservative economic ideology, because it basically says, look, your wealth is dependent on your faith and whether you ties to your pastor and what they call positive confession, which means that you can call your wealth into existence. So you don't need the government to provide you a social safety net. It doesn't matter what the government's economic policy is. Whether you prosper is based on what you do. So it's like the ultimate in, you know, the individual responsibility for your own wealth. And so I think that since it fits so nicely together, I think that they could see that these the followers of this movement were natural allies, not just on the hot-button social issues that the conservative evangelicals fall for, but for these other reasons as well.
Well, you touched on this a little bit before. I'd like to just kind of draw you out on the story of the fundamentalist Latter-day Saints. We saw a tendency for media to sort of bracket the group, kind of treat them as exotic. But our guest said that they were really more socially significant than that sort of fringe label implied. Do you see something similar here? Do you think reporters are getting deep enough into the influence and the importance of these preachers?
I don't think they are, because I think that, say, with Hagee, they focused on his prophecy about the Holocaust and that it might have been God's will, because it's so outrageous. And because they focus on these outrageous things that they say, it makes it hard for people to grasp that they actually have very committed followers. And so I think that it's helpful to go inside and see what it is that gives them this hold over their followers and why it's appealing to people. I mean, it's very scandalous and very dangerous what they do, but in a lot of ways it appeals to people's sense of, the need to have someone tell them what to do, or the need to think that they can help themselves through life's troubles, including life's financial troubles. And so I think that it's very risky to write them off as being fringy. They are fringy, but if you define fringy as not having very many followers, they're not.
So McCain's rejection of these endorsements shouldn't be the end of this story for reporters, but now that he's done it, it could be the end. How do you think reporters could sort of carry this story forward? What sorts of questions might they be asking or things they could follow up on?
Well, I think that it has to be viewed not just through the prism of the presidential campaign, but through their ongoing influence on the political process, whether it's through their advocacy for other candidates or through Hagee's advocacy on Israel issues through his Christians United for Israel. There are a lot of different angles. The Grassley investigation, you know, the Senate Finance Committee investigation, is another angle that people aren't following very closely. And the other thing to keep in mind is that a lot of McCain surrogates are still close with these people. Gary Bauer, for example, the former Reagan aide and religious right activist, is very close. He serves on Hagee's board of Christians United for Israel. He's also close with Parsley, as is Sam Brownback, who's another McCain ally. So just because McCain got this campaign trail albatross off his neck doesn't mean that he's still not trying to reach these followers through other means.
Well, this is also a story about so-called alternative media being on to a phenomenon and covering it long before it breaks into the nightly news. I think in that aspect, it's positive. Perhaps some of the big media folks will look more to other outlets for story ideas.
Right. And, you know, in my book, I show how this is not a new phenomenon for the Republicans. This is, you know, like you said, going back three decades. And I think when people put it in that kind of perspective and also explore in my book the reach and the scandals of the Word of Faith movement, that would also put in perspective for people what this is really all about, that it's not just about McCain ridding himself of some pastors who have said bigoted and controversial things.
We've been speaking with Sarah Posner, author of God's Prophets, Faith, Fraud, and the Republican Crusade for Values Voters. Thank you very much, Sarah Posner, for joining us today on Counterspin.
Thanks for having me, Janine.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by the staff and interns at FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. FAIR also publishes a bi-monthly magazine called Extra. For subscription information, you can call the following number, 1-800-847-3993. That's 1-800-847-3993. Be sure and tell them you heard about Extra here on Counterspin. If you missed part of today's show or you'd like to hear previous shows, you can find them on FAIR's website. It's www.fair.org. The show is engineered by Kelly Spivey at Mercer Media. With me is Steve Rendell. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.